You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, my name is Kirk Ellis, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Kirk Ellis. He's the author of They Kill People, Bonnie and Clyde, A Hollywood Revolution, and America's Obsession with Guns and Outlaws. Kirk, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Happier to be in Santa Fe, talking to you. Tony, be well. Yeah.
When did you come from Santa Fe, or did you decide at some point to go, you know what, I need to visit
Santa
Fe?
No, I grew up in West Texas. I grew up in El Paso. This area as a kid, but I went to college at USC to film school at University of California in LA. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Spent many years as a journalist, and then transitioned into screenwriting and producing. And about 25 years ago, my wife and I moved here, and it's been a great experience.
So that's beautiful. That's like a three act structure almost.
It is, yes, indeed. Yes.
Wow, great. El Paso. So did you leave El Paso to go to college?
No, my father worked for Sears as a store manager. So
which was huge then.
Like
that's a thing.
Big. Yeah, it was like being a military brat, but in a retail environment.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Between the time I was born at the far end of Texas in Orange, about as far east as you can get without going into Louisiana, and the time I was in sixth grade, I had lived in five different places. But I went through elementary school in El Paso, so I learned Spanish and English at the same time. I'm fluent in Spanish as a result of
wow,
that.
Wow, that's very cool.
I feel very grateful for that. But
yeah.
It also, I also learned, I was an only child, so you learned not to make too many close friendships because 2 or 3 years later, you were going to move out. So I think that in retrospect, you know, decades later, I see that as an advantage to my work as both a journalist and as a writer, because you're always trying to find the stories that you left behind.
Oh, I like that a lot. And also when you're there in the moment, there's probably, correct me if I'm wrong, but a little more urgency to find the stories of the people around you so you can fit in.
Yes, you were close to people, and then you moved on. In El Paso, at least, I was there long enough to go through almost all of my elementary school education.
Yes.
Then we shifted to Abilene, Texas.
Oh,
Went to
wow.
Colorado Springs,
Wow.
Where I went to high school.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I went to college in Los Angeles. So I had a better training as an only child than many do because of those different experiences.
Wow. That is fascinating. And to adapt, because I'm sure there's a lot of people who may have had similar experience as you who have resentment for lots of moving around instead of taking it as the superpower that it seems like that you grabbed from it.
I'm always amused in interviews where people talk about what they thought about as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually remember any of that.
Oh, okay.
But
it was so bad. It was so bad. You just blacked it out.
Well, I don't know if it was good or bad. I mean, growing up, my parents knew I was a sort of bookish lad. So, you know, home in Colorado Springs, I remember, was two stories. And downstairs, there was a family room where we got together to watch TV. But beyond that were rooms that were sort of my work room as a junior high school student and a high school student in Colorado Springs. And then there was a projection room, because I collected 8mm films you could get from places like Blackhawk in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I had movie posters strewn around the wall and a closet full of film memorabilia, and that was sort of the beginning of what became my career. I mean, originally I thought I was going to be an archaeologist or an anthropologist because you grow up in the Southwest and you're immersed in the multicultural experience. You've got the Mexican and Hispanic culture, you've got the indigenous culture, and it's impossible growing up not to be fascinated and in sort of marveling at all these other cultures. And although I didn't pursue those careers, they certainly informed what I did coming out of college and certainly what I do now as both a screenwriter and a nonfiction writer.
So what the archaeological component, is that still as large as it was back then, back at the time? Like, is there still a lot of emphasis in that region of the country on doing digs and still, or has it all kind of
Well,
been?
sure. I mean, that's all changing now because you have the indigenous cultures reclaiming their heritage from all of these colonial digs throughout the course of the entire 20th century. But living in Santa Fe is great because you're not, unlike all the years I spent in Los Angeles, you're not judged on what your last project was. You're addressed as somebody who is an active member of the community. And both my wife and I continue to remain very involved in the many nonprofits that are here in Santa Fe. I was the head of the Arts Commission here in Santa Fe for 4 years. I still serve on various boards that are involved in the cultural landscape of the area. And that all speaks to a kind of humanism that I've always tried to bring to my work, both as a reporter and as a screenwriter and producer, which is to understand the cultures that you're dealing with, you're writing about, and to try to find an inside track to that narrative.
So when you were in journalism, were you since you were in at USC, was there a were you covering films and such since you were already was that the like angle you went?
So I majored at what was then called the University of Southern California School of Cinema Television, now known as the School of, get this, Cinematic Arts, with a double major in both production and history criticism. One of my last professors in the history criticism department was the legendary film critic Arthur Knight. Sort of the he was he and Charles Chaplin really ruled that scene back in the early 80s. And through Arthur, I got a job as a proofreader for The Hollywood Reporter when they were doing their, I think at the time it was their 50th anniversary issue. And it was a job that was meant to last 3 weeks. And I was there for between 3 and 4 years. I worked my way up through the ranks. This is like a classic pre-code Warner Brothers newspaper story. I was a
And I'm
proofreader.
like, I am
Then I was
loving it. Yes, keep going.
a
Back when
copy
journalism
editor.
actually meant something.
And I was a copy editor. Then I was the business editor sharing a desk with the obituaries editor, which was phenomenal. Then I ultimately became, I think I was 24 at the time, I became the international editor of the Reporter, in charge of a fairly significant group of journalists spread out around the world. I think there were about 40 of them, 24 of whom filed regular copy. The rest of them, it was always like pulling teeth. But I learned from that experience all these different cultural resources that international cinema had, which is something that I had also gotten a real taste of when I was at USC, because USC then and now had access to not only the contemporary American filmmakers, but an incredibly wide breadth of international cinema. So it was at USC where I saw my first Truffaut films,
Wow,
my first films from Germany, my first films from the Arab world, my first films from China. And that sort of blew my, undergraduate head apart. And it left me with this wonderful sense of different narrative experiences depending on where you were from and how the stories were told. There's no one way to tell a story. I always go back to the Kurosawa film Rashomon, which for your listeners and viewers who may not know it, was the sort of groundbreaking Japanese film that told the story of an assault on a peasant couple going to market from four different points of view. There was the husband, there was the wife, there was the bandit, played by the great Toshirô Mifune, who assaults them. And then there was this final story, which was from Kurosawa, the director's point of view. So you learned that stories aren't written in stone. They differ from perspective. If I was a reporter covering a traffic accident, depending on what corner I stood on, it would be a different story than if I was across the street or diagonally across the street. So all the work that I've done, as a dramatic screenwriter, has always been about, let's look at this. Is this the story of the Beach Boys, the stories of the Three Stooges, Judy Garland and Frank? Let's look at all the different perspectives and see where we can find an underlying truth. But it's a truth that is established by me as the writer in conversation with the audience based on the story I'm telling. And I've worked with a lot of really great historians, David McCullough, Stacy Schiff, many others, Kate Clifford Larson, who did the Harriet Tubman project I developed for a couple of years with Viola Davis at HBO that never got made. But we all do the same thing. We have different parameters and different red lines about what we're willing or not willing to do as storytellers, but it's a similar skill.
And as a screenwriter, there's more what do they call it? Cooks in the kitchen. But and sometimes that works because you get the right cooks in the kitchen, and then sometimes probably that
Sure.
line to fight is a lot harder, yeah.
Yeah, I've been lucky with my collaborators. I've not really had one of those experiences where you'd simply throw up your hands and go, I don't care anymore. They're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
But in looking at when I was contemplating the book that became They Kill People, I realized that I had this breadth of experience with how historical narratives are shaped into a kind of dramatic history that over time can become a myth. And to try to look at our national history, through that lens that Bonnie and Clyde provided. So that became, it's like, oh, my life experience is actually worth something, at this point.
Oh man, I'm glad you found it because I'm still trying to find mine. It's that's fascinating because I love the idea, and I teach screenwriting as well, and so I talk to my students like I'm just like you have no idea, even if you're writing a rom-com, you are shifting the mythology of the story
Of
of
course.
humanity. There is a shift, and it's always there, and how much fun it is to be a part of the shift, and how much fun it is to actually realize, oh wait, but these films or even these books, they're mirrors of the culture at that moment. They're snapshots of time, and
Right.
There's no, and that's why there's no way to like some of these, like, let's remake a film. And it's just like, oh, kind of bad idea because that was a moment of time. And then they remake it and you're like, oh, you did it even better than the original. I'm sorry. The one I think of off the top of my head is Ocean's 11, where I feel like they took that to like, when they said, oh, they're going to remake Ocean's 11, and I remember, I was younger and I was like, that's a really bad idea. And then all of a
Well,
sudden, it's like,
in its era, okay, that sort of Rat Pack, mid-century modern era, that is a definitive movie. Does it age well? Not at all. So the films that endure are the ones that are both of their time but transcend their time. And Bonnie and Clyde is certainly a film that does that because though it was set in the 60, the 30s, it spoke to an audience in the 60s who were going through much the same thing in terms of youth, authority, repression, disenfranchisement. And what's remarkable about it is that it still speaks to us on the same level. And that was one of the reasons I really wanted to celebrate it, but also to use it as a lens through which we could talk about this uniquely American identification with lawbreakers and how that identification is wrapped up in our firearms culture. And that's something that Arthur Penn, even more than David Newman and Robert Benton, the screenwriters, really understood when he took on the assignment of making the film.
I was talking about this. I can't remember with who, but well, probably because I talk about it a lot and think about it a lot. So I probably talked about it with like 10 people. Maybe it's not just one, but the idea of like, I adore heist films. I adore bank robbery films. And I ask myself, why do I adore these things? Because these things are crimes. Like if somebody robs a bank, that's a criminal thing to do. But if I'm watching it on the screen, and even if someone robs a bank, there's a I just oh smash cut. There's one
Hey,
there's one there's one film I just watched. What was it called? Silent Partner with Elliot Gould and Christopher
Terrific,
Plummer.
Christopher Plummer. Wonderful film. Yes,
Yeah, I don't know how that landed on my radar, but that was I think it landed because it was just like this kind of quote obscure heist film right around night right 1980.
Canadian heist film as well.
Oh, it was Canadian? Yeah, and it
Yes,
but
Daryl Duke.
okay, yeah. And even though like there's flaws in it, I adore it no matter what. And it's because the bank is getting the bank. I have a is and I don't know if this is an American culture thing, but the idea of robbing like a bank, which is the so-called, I guess, epitome of who's in charge of our economy, and getting one over on the system, it's like an anti-authority thing, like you were saying. It brings up the anti-authority where I'm like, oh, they got away with it, and we can live like vicariously through them in the hopes that one day we'll get our shot where all of a sudden we get a huge bag of money. But what do we do when we get a huge bag of money? Well, then that's for therapy and the drug addiction that we gain when we get all the money, because then we get the good drugs.
Well, it's an endorphin high, that whole rebellion aspect of things.
Even just to rebel is endorphins. I didn't even think of that.
But I mean, in the depression that in which Bonnie and Clyde, committed their crimes, bank robbery wasn't necessarily seen in a negative way, because so many banks had foreclosed on sharecroppers, farmers, middle class homeowners. It was a terrible, terrible time. So there were no Robin Hoods. None of these bandits, whether you're talking about Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, whoever, they weren't Robin Hoods. They didn't rob from the rich to give to the poor. They robbed to benefit themselves. But yet they became folk heroes in our culture because of their stance against authority. And One of the things that kind of shocks people when I talk about the film is that, in the 1930s, people who killed cops, cop killings weren't necessarily seen as a bad thing because the police were part of that whole authority that was being challenged.
Was there also
And,
corruption at the time too? Because I feel like
oh, of
there's
course
pro
there was.
I
Oh,
mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the 1960s, when the film was released, audiences, particularly inner city and black audiences and underprivileged audiences, stood up and applauded, those murders because they were seeing that oppression on the streets every day. So it's and we're now, again, I mean, one of the reasons that I think the book has touched a nerve is that we're now reliving the 30s and the 60s in real time with what we're seeing, on American streets. And the book makes no, I was scrupulous not to have an opinion about Second Amendment rights, our anti-authoritarian rebellion. It was simply a matter to present it, in this structure where you had chapters about the making of the film, chapters about the real Barrow Gang, and then the larger issues in American history that both the real story and the fictional story, what you might want to call the real story, REEL, became touchstones for.
It's fascinating. And with this, do you think these things are kind of cyclical? Like the like there's like another 30 to 40 years from now, we're going to be in the same mess if we figure out a way to put this mess like together, and all of a sudden we got a moment of decaf utopia, and then
Ha!
that happens for a while,
Yes.
and then all of a
Ha!
sudden it's just going to
Yes.
go back.
So, history isn't a straight line. I've learned that over time in my experience. History is a cycle, okay? And a circle endlessly repeats itself. The famous quote is from Mark Twain: "History doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it often rhymes."
Yeah, that's
And
right.
American history is a series of rhymes that
Yeah.
we continue to alter, but it's the same story retold again and again.
Yeah. And with looking at other cultures, like especially like with their like other film cultures, like say the film culture of France or the film culture of India, which India is probably bigger than Hollywood. I mean, I would assume, I'm not sure. But wait,
Oh, yes, the
are
largest film culture in the world. Yes,
yeah,
just
yeah,
based
yeah.
on population, 900 million people.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah. No, if you're a star in India, there is the Brad Pitt of India, and Brad Pitt of India has probably got three times as many people clamoring onto him than Brad
Oh,
Pitt
yes.
does.
At the very least, yes.
I wish I knew more. I don't know if you followed Bollywood, but I really haven't, and I need to start diving into it, just because it's such a huge portion of the mythology of Earth. Because I because we because
Yeah, well,
I
Star
got
Wars
a
RRR, which actually won an Oscar for best song a few years ago at the Academy Awards, and you'll learn a lot about, how Bollywood culture takes legends that are much, much older than ours and transforms them into a modern guise. But you're mentioning other film cultures, and I mean, one of the things to know about Bonnie and Clyde as a film is that the writers, Robert Benton and David Newman, were film geeks, and they were hugely influenced by the French New Wave, Truffaut,
Oh,
Godard,
interesting.
Chabrol,
Okay, yeah.
all those legendary filmmakers who started as critics and looked at American films as a kind of touchstone for what they wanted to do, but then transformed the visual and narrative landscape. And they were looking to do an American gangster film. Talking about the screenwriters, an American gangster film that was also a Western, but inflected by this whole new wave technique. And they wrote it very much in that shadow, and they found they courted Arthur Penn, or sorry, they courted Francois Truffaut, they courted Jean-Luc Godard before they found Arthur Penn, who was the American filmmaker who was the most in tune with the French New Wave, you know, and who knew what he wanted to deliver. But Penn also was someone who understood and said in his press conferences for the film that the history of America is a history of violence, and that Americans are more prone to violent outbursts than any other culture. And so he brought that to the script. And that's what has made the film so timeless and so contemporary.
Fascinating. And it's also, I guess, if we look back even further into the like the and I saw that you did a series on Benjamin Franklin and you worked on that and I
Yes.
and with Michael Douglas and I gotta watch that. It looks really good. But when we go back to say either the Founding Fathers or before that, like the United States has always kind of been a wild, hot west of insanity in some way that somehow pulled something together. It's such a weird experiment.
So if I'm known for anything as a creator, it's for the 2008 HBO miniseries John Adams with Paul Giamatti and Lon Winnie. And in that show, Paul delivers one of John Adams's signature lines: America should be a nation of laws, not men. And that's how we've always based our understanding of our republic. Yet our history is full of explosions of cataclysmic violence, whether you're talking about the Civil War or what's happening on the streets today. So we live in this, I don't know, this fundamental paradox of a nation of laws populated by a nation of lawbreakers. And it's the lawbreakers, not the law-abiding citizens, who get all of our historical and mythological respect.
Wow, interesting. And this was like a few years ago. I didn't know anything about John Adams, and I read about him, and I think it was like him. I don't know if it was him and his father. I don't even know all the presidents. I could probably name half of them, but one of the really interesting things that kind of threw me back was this when I read this one book, and I wish I could remember to attribute the author. But it's about John Adams going to France, and having to take the ship, having to just take a transatlantic ship across to France. Like now we can just go to France and be there from the West Coast in like 10 hours or whatever, right? And it's just like they had to fight. They had to make sure that they could fight pirates. They can get passage through the English areas of the sea. Then once they got there, they landed in the wrong spot. So then they had to like take a caravan. That took about like 3 weeks to get up from France
So
into
the book you're
Paris.
talking about is actually the book I adapted.
No
It's David
way.
McCullough's book, John Adams. Yes. Yeah, which
I'm
tells
so
that story.
excited to watch it. Okay, that's such a roundabout way to come to you.
Yes. So it was actually that book, and yes, it was about, you know, we always think of people in the past as having a simpler life, that nothing could be further from the truth. The life was very different. It was much harder. It was more existential. There were none of the technological advances that make our life quite easy. Oh, you know, there's a smallpox epidemic in Philadelphia. What should I do? Text. You know, John and Abigail Adams didn't have that option. If there was a crisis, they had to deal with it individually, and the partner would find out about it weeks later after it had been resolved. Communication.
You'll go ahead.
was much more difficult. Yeah.
And it's so mind-blowing because I could be in another country and feel so lonely that I'm there like alone and like I have no friends in the city or whatever, and I'm like being brave and travel quote I'm doing air quotes here and traveling alone, and it's just like this is nothing, dude. It's like look back, just like it's kind of recent history when we go back only a few hundred years, and it's like it's so
Sure.
close and so right on top of us at the same time. That the we have luxury issues sometimes. We have luxury problems.
That's right. That's right. I mean, history is a product of technology. As the technology advances, things happen on a much more rapid basis.
Yeah.
But what we've lost over time because of those advances is the ability of an individual to make a decision in solitude without all of this noise
Oh,
surrounding you.
interesting. Yeah.
And that's what you learn. That's true of film, because when I was going through the cinema department at USC, we were doing 16 millimeter film, and you were cutting negative when you made a final print. But you're working on these old moviolas that had an accelerator pedal for you to get the film through the screen, and you've got a grease pencil to mark where your cuts are. So when you're doing it physically, you're thinking many steps ahead, because if you misjudge that cut, you're then going to have to take that splice apart, right? It's a piece of tape on both sides of the film. You're going to take it apart, you're going to put the film back together, you're going to put it back through the moviola, and you're going to recut it. When you can do all the stuff digitally, really doesn't matter. You can do it over and over again, and endlessly, without having any kind of physical product. And I think it's made people lazy. It's made people lazy as writers, certainly with the introduction of AI and ChatGPT, and a way to sort of talk your way into or out of your own script. It certainly made them lazy on sets where you've got any number of cameras covering the action, where you're going to have all this digital info that's going to then go into the editing room that you can cut. It's made everybody lazy, and the films are lazier, the stories are lazier, everything's lazier.
It's almost like having the so-called handicap of the hands-on actually made the people of that time have to think through the problem before they made a cut, because that physical cut was a
Right.
was high stakes. So then you gotta so your
That's right.
our brains are mentally. It's like even now where my spelling is terrible because when I'm working on Microsoft Word or I'm sending an email, it tries to correct it and it tells me, and so I've gotten
And
lazy.
we don't read through it, and we don't catch the errors. Yes, right.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
that it's one I did college radio in the early 1990s. So I remember we did that with audio. That's how we made all of our
Yeah,
spots
that's what you're
with
slicing tape.
cuts on your
Exactly.
hands.
Yeah.
It's like came back with battle scars. But like to this day, I still write. Like if I'm working on a book, I write. My first draft is on paper, and it's just on legal pads with a cheap pen.
Right.
And I feel like that is it slows the process down, but it kind of keeps me battlefield ready in a way because I'm thinking in a different way when it's eyes to pen to brain instead of using the obstacle of a $2,000 machine and that can do essentially the exact same thing as my handwriting. I do have to transcribe it into the machine, but
Sure.
at least I have that first tactical thing that I've needed for many years. And it could be because I'm an older fella and I also have always handwritten, but I
Well,
also
we
feel
always
like
remember this. I mean, yeah, when I worked at the Hollywood Reporter all those years, we were one of the last of the trade papers, even of the Los Angeles dailies to go on computers. So we were working on IBM Selectric 3s, which, if you remember, you turn them on, they had this hum. But it's a challenge to put something on paper. And they had these cylinders, these circular type balls, unlike conventional typewriters with keys and all that, like a piano. So the ball would like rotate and strike, and you'd strike and strike, and it was there were you got a sense of a real tactile sense of what you were doing. So you would write a story, you'd send it to the city desk, they would cut it up literally with scissors and sort of restructure it, send it back to you, you'd retype it, then it would go back into typesetting, where you had professional typesetters, working at these machines, who would put it into print, pop it onto an actual proof page, then you would read it again. You're only so many steps removed from Benjamin Franklin in the 18th century, working on an old press. And that was great. And it taught you to, again, it taught you to be specific. But once everything converted to computers, I learned that you were doing a first draft on the screen, then you'd print it out, you'd read it, you'd edit it on paper, you'd then do another version on the screen, then it would go back into the copy room and come back at you, and you would do it again. And that's still what I do here on my home desktop. I'm always using it as revisions, but I'm still old school in that I can't read anything on the computer. I have to print it out.
Same here. I have to print out everything that I edit. I can't look on the screen and edit. It's got to be in my hands, and I got to have the red lines and all the squigglies, and it just makes me feel so much better. It not only makes me feel better about myself, it makes me feel better than most of humanity.
Ha! Why? Why?
No. Maybe it does. I just look down at these kids at these cafes with their laptops and I'm saying, you don't even know what it's like. How much
Well, but
fun it
still,
is. You're not
I
even
did.
having fun.
I was doing the copy editing of my book. It was on, printed paper, at a coffee shop. In fact, Collected Works, where we're doing the official launch tomorrow here in Santa Fe, and surrounded by people who were doing much the same thing on their laptops. I didn't begrudge them that effort, but I just enjoyed being able to read my own work on the printed page with a cup of coffee and a red pen, in a red pen like this.
Is that, I even wrote this in my journal today because I write my daily complaints. I try to have a gratitude list and it just turns into complaints. But what was I writing today? I was writing the I may need to put a club together, the disgruntled old men, and that could be a cafe where there's just like no devices. There's like just no. You bring in your work, and you better we need to see your work because we need to make sure you're not just writing a self-conscious blog. We need to know you're writing something of substance just
Yeah,
to
by the
even
way,
get into this place.
blogging isn't writing. Blogging is just sort of vomiting up your thoughts without any structure. Writing requires structure. So,
Craft.
with
We need
respect
a
to all the
craft.
bloggers who may be listening to this podcast.
Well, zero respect to all the bloggers. I hope they stop listening. Just stop right now and don't ever listen again. Oh, I want to go back to something. Flashback. When we were talking about John Adams and we were talking about decision making and also the solitude of creating a decision. Were you kind of speaking to the to how it's almost like we don't have time to stop these days to really just think about the gravity of a decision we make, or what was.
Sure, that becomes any kind of historical research you do. If you're delving into even the recent past of like half a century ago, you realize how difficult communications were, and how much importance lay in the individual decision. So yes, you're always struck by that when you go back in time to decision makers and major historical pivot points, that nothing was determined. Everything could have gone in any number of directions. There was no destiny to things. That's one of the problems with historical reconstruction. Certainly, when you see it, is that characters are aware of their historical importance. None of them were aware of that. They were simply trying to make the best decision possible for the future. Sometimes they got it right, sometimes they didn't, but they made decisions.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You fascinated me so much. I lost my thought.
It's good.
Because what's interesting is, like, even if we say that they got it right, maybe there was a more writer decision that none of
We'll
us could
never
even.
know. We'll never know. I mean, we live in, we live, all of us, regardless of what cultures we're from, what geographical boundaries our countries may lie in, we're all a product of the people who came before us. And we can look back on that world with pride, or we can look back on it with a certain amount of regret. But this history is messy, and it's complicated. It's gray. It's never black and white. And it's up to us to acknowledge all of that, and to use that knowledge to move forward.
To try to be our own better people, even as I get older, I'm like,
Better angels of our nature, is Lincoln famously phrased it.
oh, what was the phrase again? I was talking
Better angels of our nature.
better
We're always
angels of
looking
our
to
nature.
be those better angels.
What now, when going back to the John Adams project, were you what did someone talk to you and say, hey, would you be interested in it? Or was this something that you were kind of driving towards because you
No,
had a
that's how almost everything comes your way. Sure, you reach a point where you're developing your own projects, but I've been lucky that really good people have brought me really good material. And that was certainly the way that John Adams happened. But you have to understand that with both that project back in, which came out in 2008, and Franklin, which came out in 2023, those projects, is that right? Yeah, 2024, sorry. That those projects occupied 6 years of my working life, from page to screen. They're long journeys, and you have to be willing to commit to the project, both physically and professionally, but also on a sheerly emotional level. You've got to make sure you're gonna want to be with these people, these subjects, not your collaborators, but the subjects of the work, for that period of time.
So it's almost like, I mean, it's it because if you're spending 6 to 8 hours a day on going through John Adams or a Ben Franklin or an Anne Frank project, these people probably, well, for me, if I'm working on something, they're more intimate than my friend. They're even more intimate
Of
if I'm in a
course,
relationship because I'm spending a lot more time with them emotionally on the
Well, you get to
page.
know everything about them, which you don't do with your friends, or even with your closest relationship, whether that's a wife or a spouse or a significant other. I mean, it's you're living with these people, and you know what you like about them, what you don't like about them, and on any given day, those characteristics are going to come to the fore, and you've got to be able to deal with them.
When you're at the end of a project, and it's you've gone as far as you can with it. I don't know if you are you were you, are you involved in the edit as well? When
Oh
you're
yeah, as a I've been lucky in my career, particularly with the larger projects, to be a producer as well as a writer. So yes, you're with it until it's on the air or on the screen. Yeah, and then that's when you have to say goodbye. Sometimes you've said goodbye months before. Other times it's really, really hard to make that break.
Wait, what when is what why would it be hard to make that break?
Well, because you've been living in this world for so long, and on the course of a long form series, Unlike a movie, you're there for a year working with people. It's more than just a circus. It's a collection of artists who are coming together for a specific project. And you have the personal goodbyes, but then there's also the years that you have spent that they haven't developing this material and living with these characters. And I've learned over time that when a project is over, you've got to take a break, take a long vacation, don't work on anything else, reconnect with your real life, because you have to simply transition into something else.
I watched a trailer of the Michael Douglas Benjamin series, and it showed a clip of it showed a rolling what do they call it when you're a dolly shot of Versailles out
Yeah.
by the fountains, and I was and I just
Sure.
sat there and I went, Kirk was probably there. They probably had
Oh,
Versailles all
I'm
to
not complaining
themselves.
about that. That was a 121 day shoot. I relocated to Paris for the better part of a year. I have no complaints about that. It's one of the best productions I've ever been on. And Michael Douglas himself said the same thing when it was all over. And
Just have
it
that
was a
kind of
different way of
access.
Well, it's a different way of working. And also, we were shooting that series on practical locations. There aren't that many sets in those 8 hours, and you there's a feeling you get both as somebody involved in the production, but more importantly, somebody watching the show who understands those are that's real. There's a sense of lived-in reality in those costumes and on those locations that no CGI can replicate.
No. And it's
It's an emotional and tactile reality.
and that's the thing where I think we lose trust with the audience, even if we add a little bit of CGI. The audience may not be aware of it, but there's something of a dishonesty to it where I feel like they can pick up on it on a on a visceral level and go, oh, I kind of like that film, but and they don't know why they don't like it, but I just feel like that's when a film or a series loses the honesty. It loses
Well,
the
people see it as a kind of fakery, not authentic. And everything that we do as storytellers, whether it's a dramatic miniseries or a nonfiction book about Bonnie and Clyde, you're always going for the sense of authenticity. Verisimilitude is the pretentious 25-cent word for that.
Did you when you're working on the Bonnie and Clyde book, was there a part of you that just really wished you could go back in time and be a part of that whole set, or was the other part going, thank God I wasn't part of any of that, but it's so much fun to be on this side of it?
I did, in a way, go back to it because halfway through the writing the book, I took a 2 week break and went to Texas, this what's now called the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, to research both Bonnie and Clyde's journey and the actual film locations. And I was able to visit almost all the original film locations that still existed, and it was like it was stuck in time. The locations that Dean Tavalaris, the art director, found in 1966, they're all still there, and they really haven't changed that much in a half century. So it was a great bit of time travel through that, and to see, both what the location conditions were when they filmed the movie, but also how these towns looked in the 30s when Bonnie and Clyde were rampaging through them as well. And to see how that outlaw culture, there are the Pilot Point, which is the town in which they film one of the great robbery scenes about midway through Bonnie and Clyde, still does a Bonnie and Clyde Days. So an outlaw couple that would have been pariahs in the Depression, now are celebrated, and every October there's this big deal where everybody dresses up they reenact the bank robbery. Whether that's the bank robbery from the film or the actual bank robbery, I can't tell you. It's all blurred in
Yeah.
time and in history. But that says a lot about the outlaw culture in Arcadia, Louisiana, where Bonnie and Clyde were killed in this extrajudicial killing by Texas Rangers and members of the Dallas Police Force. They reenacted Bonnie and Clyde days, 2 days of festivities, endless reenactments of the massacre, accompanied by a fair, sort of midway along the main street, hot dogs, cotton candy, you name it. It's great. But that's all part of our celebration of these lawbreakers.
And these lawbreakers don't even know how great they're celebrated. That is so
Well,
fascinating.
people get married on the site where Bonnie and Clyde were killed.
Wow. Romance.
They
It's
leave
a
notes.
romance.
Yeah, they leave notes for him. I mean, I don't know if Bonnie and
Wow.
Clyde are going to read these notes, but notes
Yeah.
left for them on the site after the wedding.
Yeah.
So.
That is so cool. You've just added to my itinerary trips to Texas and Louisiana in my travel bucket list coming up in the next couple
It's
of
roughly
years.
Memorial Day weekend every year
Okay.
in
Wow.
May.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah.
That's amazing. His name is Kirk Ellis. The book is called They Kill People, Bonnie and Clyde, A Hollywood Revolution, and America's Obsession with Guns and Outlaws. Kirk, thank you for coming on the show.
No, it's been a great conversation. Thank you. Really appreciate it, Tony. Happy to come back anytime.
Okay, I'll see you next week.
All right. Okay, great.
Vous avez lu l'histoire de Jesse James? Comment-il vécu? Comment-il est mort? Ça vous a plu, hein? Vous en demandez encore? Et son prénom c'est
Bonnie.
À eux deux, ils forment le gang Barrow. Leur nom
Bonnie Parker
est Clyde Barrow.
Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde. Moi, lorsque j'ai connu Clyde autrefois, c'était un gars loyal, honnête et droit.
Il faut croire que c'est la société qui m'a définitivement abîmé.
Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde.
Qu'est-ce qu'on n'a pas écrit sur elle et moi?
Tant que nous tuons de sang-froid,
c'est pas drôle, mais on est bien obligé
de faire taire celui qui se met à gueuler. Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde.
Chaque fois qu'un policeman se fait buter,
qu'un garage ou qu'une banque se fait braquer,
pour la police ça ne fait pas de mystère.
C'est signé
Clyde Barrow,
Bonnie Parker, Bonnie and Clyde.
Maintenant, chaque fois qu'on essaie de se ranger,
de s'installer tranquille dans un meublé,
dans les 3 jours, voilà le tac-tac-tac.
Des mitraillettes qui reviennent à l'attaque. Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde. pense qu'il me fasse la peau. Moi, Bonnie, je tremble pour Clyde Barrow. Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde.
De toute façon, il ne pouvait plus s'en sortir.
La seule solution, c'était mourir.
Les a suivis en enfer.
Quand sont morts Barrow et Bonnie Parker, Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
C'est étrange. Je ne sais pas ce qui m'arrive ce soir. Je te regarde comme pour la première fois.
Encore des mots, toujours des mots.
Je ne sais plus comment te dire.
Rien que des mots.
Mais tu es cette belle histoire d'amour que je ne cesserai jamais de lire.
Des mots faciles, des mots fragiles, c'était trop beau.
Tu es d'hier et de demain.
Bien trop beau.
De toujours, ma seule vérité.
Mais c'est fini, le temps des rêves. Les souvenirs se font aussi.
Tu es comme le vent qui fait chanter le violon et emporte au loin le parfum des roses.
Caramel, bonbon et chocolat.
Par moments, je ne te comprends pas.
Merci pas pour moi, mais tu peux bien les offrir à une autre qui aime le vent et le parfum des roses. Moi, les mots tendres enrobés de douceur se posent sur ma bouche. Jamais sur mon cœur.
Une parole encore.
Paroles, paroles, paroles.
Écoute-moi.
Paroles, paroles, paroles.
Je t'en prie.
Paroles, paroles, paroles.
Je te jure.
Paroles, 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 paroles. Paroles, encore des paroles. Que tu sais nos mots.
Voilà mon destin. Te parler. Parler comme la première fois.
Encore des mots, toujours des mots, les mêmes mots.
Comme j'aimerais que tu me comprennes.
Rien que des mots.
Que tu m'écoutes au moins une fois.
Des mots magiques, des mots tactiques qui sonnent faux.
Tu es mon rêve défendu.
Oui, tellement faux.
Mon seul tourment et mon unique espérance.
Ne t'arrête quand tu commences. Si tu savais comme j'ai envie d'un peu de silence.
Tu es pour moi la seule musique qui fait danser les étoiles sur les dunes.
Caramel, bonbon et chocolat.
Si tu n'existais pas déjà, je t'inventerais.
Merci pas pour moi, mais tu peux bien les offrir à une autre. Jamais sur mon cœur.
Encore un mot, juste une parole.
Parole, parole, parole.
Écoute-moi.
Parole, parole, parole.
Je t'en prie.
Parole, parole, parole.
Je te jure.
Parole, 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 parole. Parole, encore des paroles. Que tu sais mon mot.
Que tu es belle. Que tu es belle.
Parole, parole, parole.
Que tu es belle.
Parole, parole, parole.
Que tu es belle.
Parole.